Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, the journalist and historian Gareth Porter will explain what's going on in Syria. And at the bottom of the hour, Jerry Davis outlines a little-appreciated transformation at the summit of U.S. society. First, Gareth Porter. Going into this interview, I knew almost nothing about what's going on in Syria other than recoiling at the horror of it all. Who are the rebels, precisely? Who are the outside actors? And what roles are the major outside powers, the U.S. and Russia, playing, and why? Here's Gareth Porter, an independent journalist and historian based in Washington, with a story. We're hearing a lot of talk about intervening in Syria. Hillary Clinton seems very hot on it. Barack Obama seems less hot on it, although he's not uninvolved. What's going on the ground? Who are the forces that people identify as the Syrian opposition? We have people left of center advocating support for certain forces in Syria. Other people saying they're all just a bunch of jihadis. Give us a rundown. Who are these people?
Well, you're right that there is a view or there are two very different views of who the opposition forces are in Syria, depending on what one's political interests or political view is of the conflict. And, you know, this is because of the history of the Syrian conflict going through very different phases. And in different phases, you had a different group that was most prominent or which was dominating the opposition to the Assad regime. At the beginning, in 2011, of course, it was a mixture of sort of left-wing, I don't want to say revolutionaries, but some of them were revolutionary in their ideology, liberal Democrats, and some Islamists, specifically the Muslim Brotherhood, who were very prominent in the original protests against the Assad regime, and really played an important role in organizing some of the major protests. They were the ones who called some of the major protests.
Were these forces operating in concert individually? How did they relate to each other?
They were cooperating insofar as they were all coming together in some of these protests, but as I understand it, at least, there was not a council of all of the various elements involved in the protests that was making decisions. It was called by, certainly in some cases, by the Muslim Brotherhood without consulting all of the other parts of the opposition. What you would have during that spring and summer was some protests where you'd have different slogans being offered by different parts of the opposition. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood was calling for a very hardline approach to the regime, basically not really giving any quarter and making demands that were not endorsed by some of the more liberal elements of the opposition. So I think the answer in general to the question is that they were not coordinated from the top, at least at the beginning.
Now, how did these forces relate to what now seems like a quaint phrase, the Arab Spring?
Well, certainly the Arab Spring was beginning at that point, and I think the timing of the protests was largely determined by the sense on the part of more than one of these parts of the overall opposition that this was the time to make a move, that this would be supported from abroad by the United States and other Western countries. They would be able to put pressure on the Assad regime, and so therefore the view was that this would be the time to really put the most pressure, put the pressure we could on the Assad regime.
If you start speaking skeptically of intervening in Syria in any way, you immediately get called an Assadist. So let's talk about the Assad regime itself. What was it all about? What was its base, power base, and what was it like going into this period of rebellion?
Maybe before we talk about the Assad regime itself, let me just finish, at least in a general sense, the description of the opposition, because what I described is the nature of the opposition in 2011. But by 2012, you've got a very different situation there in the opposition, because you had the jihadists coming in from outside of Syria. Some of them were already in Syria, but there was a very large contingent of jihadists representing al-Qaeda coming from Iraq, and then pretty soon coming from other parts of the world, from Chechnya, for example, which were drawn into this struggle against the Assad regime. And clearly hearing the call from jihadists in Iraq and then in Syria, they were transforming the opposition to the Assad regime, because they were bringing thousands of foreign fighters into the country, along with a very disciplined political military organization, which very quickly played a key role in the military part of the opposition by carrying out terrorist operations, not only in some of the places where the opposition had started, in Daraa and elsewhere, but also in Damascus itself. So very quickly, al-Qaeda became a critical element of the opposition. And by mid-2012, U.S. intelligence was very well aware, because, as we now know, they had issued a DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, had issued a report in August 2012 pointing out that the jihadists, the Salafists, that is, those who were not jihadists but who were very hardline Islamists calling for a caliphate in some cases, and the Muslim Brotherhood were key players, now the key players in the opposition to Assad. So it had already been transformed by mid-2012.
Okay, can we go back to just getting some sense of what the Assad regime was like going into this period of uprising?
Very interestingly, the Assad regime was regarded in the United States government and Western governments as by no means the worst of the Arab regimes in terms of its governance. And I think generally Assad, the young Assad, who had become president in 1999-2000, as I recall, was regarded as kind of a reformist, trying to bring about some reform, certainly in the economy and to a lesser degree in governance. He was making promises to some of the liberals before the demonstrations began in 2011, that he was going to make changes in the political system that would be responsive to their desires. But then once the protests took place, the Assad regime really put on the mailed fist, and they responded with force. And there was at that point then, I think, a process of tit for tat, which resulted in very quickly an escalation of violence on both sides.
Yeah, the regime was responded with great brutality, didn't it?
Yes, yes. I mean, they were responding by making mass arrests. They were hoping to stop this right from the start. I mean, that's obviously the hope that the Assad regime had. Now, there was a point early in the process where they were making they were releasing people from the jails, some of whom were Islamists, some of whom were jihadists even, and they have been blamed for that by their critics, and perhaps rightly so, on the grounds that they knew those people would take to an armed opposition, and that the Assad regime would be able to portray this as the jihadists taking over, and thus isolate the legitimate democratic opposition in the country. But there were some people who were not jihadists who were also being released from prison. So it's a bit of a murky situation here, exactly what the calculus was on the part of the Assad regime in the spring summer of 2011.
Now, you spoke of a democratic opposition. Of course, you know, we're conditioned to think of those as the good guys. How prominent were they in this opposition, the broader opposition?
Well, you know, it's difficult to assess the power that different parts of the opposition had in 2011, but I think it's easier to just assess this by 2012, because as time went on and the hardliners entered the scene, that is, the people who were ready to carry out a real war to try to overthrow the regime, the democratic elements in the picture lost their power, relatively speaking, to the people who had the guns, people who had the force. And so, I mean, I think as time went by, just certainly over the last few years, the major shift has been that the jihadists, Al-Qaeda, and then ISIS, really have become the ones who were able to take control. And you know, if you bring it down to the present, if you look at Aleppo, for example, the reality is that it's Al-Qaeda that really runs the show. They are the ones who are in a position to determine which opposition organization is allowed to have which position in local government and to have which responsibility. And they are the ones who are in control of the entire military command structure. And so the supposed moderate, quote-unquote, opposition groups are really subordinate to Al-Qaeda in that sense. And this does not mean that they've totally given up their own ideology, but it does mean that they no longer are capable of operating independently of the jihadists.
I'm speaking with the independent journalist and historian, Gareth Porter. So how did we get from that point, 2011, 2012, to the scenes of just heart-wrenching destruction and death and displacement that we're, you know, we see in the papers today?
Well, I think the critical change was what happened in late 2011 when the Sunni allies of the United States, that is Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, made the decision to essentially build this opposition force to overthrow the Assad regime. And they really built it from scratch. I mean, they, you know, there were some defectors from the Assad regime during the summer and later in 2011, early 2012, but they did not really have an army. I mean, there was no opposition army until the Sunni allies made the decision themselves to fund it and to organize it.
Why? What was in it for them?
What was in it for them? Well, they basically viewed the Assad regime as an ally of Iran and decided that it was in their interest to the interest of sort of regional balance of power. And this, of course, particularly the Saudi view was the one that was pushing this idea. It was in their interest to see the Iranians defeated in Syria, to have their primary ally taken out of the picture. That I'm not saying that's the only interest, but that appears to be the main interest that animated certainly the Saudis. Now, in the case of Turkey, it's a bit of a different storyline because the President Erdogan was actually fairly friendly to Assad right up until late 2011. In fact, when the protests began in the spring of 2011, early 2011, he was advising Assad to take certain steps to try to calm things down. And when Assad did not follow his advice, the word is that the reports are that Erdogan was very angry with Assad and decided to throw his lot in with Qatar and Saudi Arabia in trying to overthrow him. And once they went down that road, there apparently was no turning back.
And what was Washington doing as our friends were sponsoring this opposition?
Well, that, of course, is a critical point in this whole story. And that's the part of the story that is least well understood, in fact. And I've been trying to piece it together, and I have a few pieces of information. I don't certainly have the whole picture. But as far as I've been able to tell, what happened in late 2011 was that the Obama administration, when it saw its Sunni allies making this decision, was not persuaded that this was a great idea. I mean, they were a little bit concerned about the implications of it, but they were not willing to say no. They were not willing to say, look, this is a terrible idea. We're going to get ourselves into a sectarian, violent conflict, and it's going to escalate into horrible killing. So instead of putting its foot down and saying no to its allies, the Obama administration said, well, we're not going to join you, but we will provide some logistical help. And that's where Petraeus, General David Petraeus, who had just become CIA director, came up with this cockamamie scheme for a covert operation that would provide sort of logistical and intelligence support for this effort by the Turks, Qataris, and Saudis to arm an armed opposition to the Assad regime.
Was this the so-called moderate opposition that they found?
Well, I mean, that was supposed to be the idea, that originally they were going to find people who would not be, certainly not be jihadists. That's the way it was being discussed. But very quickly, it turned out that the people who were getting the arms were al-Qaeda and their close allies, Ahrar al-Sham, which is not formally part of al-Qaeda, but is so close it might as well be. And so by 2012, the U.S. government, the Obama administration, knew very well that this scheme was turning into a way of channeling arms into al-Qaeda. And just recently, the guy who was in charge of counterterrorism in Turkey, who's come out of the country now and is telling everything that he knows about what the Turkish policy was, has revealed that Turkey indeed deliberately began funneling arms to al-Qaeda and then to ISIS. Basically, whole truckloads of arms were being shipped across the border, being protected by the Turkish intelligence agency. And as counterterrorism official in the police, he found out about it, and when he tried to prevent it, he was told to lay off. And so it's very clear that the Turkish government was very deeply involved very early on, knowingly passing arms to al-Qaeda.
And then how'd the Russians get involved?
Well, they got involved, of course, because they are allies of Syria. They've had a base in Syria for many years. But they became involved here because in 2014-2015, the opposition, the al-Qaeda-led opposition, was becoming much stronger militarily. And the reason was that they were getting anti-tank missiles that the United States had approved being sent to the opposition groups. And, of course, they were going through Turkey as well as some through Jordan, but primarily through Turkey. And so this was strengthening the forces that were fighting against the Assad regime tremendously. And as a result, they were able to take over an entire province, Idlib province, in the north of Syria on the Turkish border. And that was a strategic shift in the war, which was so significant that there was real fear that the al-Qaeda-led forces could make a breakthrough and even threaten the Alawite stronghold of the country, which was along the coast. And so it was at that point that the Iranians went to Moscow and said, look, you've got to do something to prevent the potential overthrow of the government and the takeover by the jihadists in Syria. And that's when the Russians made the decision in late summer of 2015 to intervene with air power.
Now, we have people like Hillary Clinton talking about a no-fly zone. She did disclose to one of her Goldman Sachs speeches that far from being a sanitized operation, it actually would involve lots of civilian death. She hasn't said that publicly, as far as I know. But what about this no-fly zone? It sounds sensible, but what really is it all about?
Well, it's very important to understand what you just said, that in fact, it was understood in 2012 and 2013 when this was under discussion in Washington, in the Obama administration, both when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and later. And when it was discussed, the U.S. military made the point that this is not going to be a turkey shoot by any means. This setting up a no-fly zone means having to eliminate the entire air defense system of Syria. And when you're talking about the Syrian air defense system, you're talking about a very sophisticated operation. Remember, this is 2012, before 2012-2013, before the Russians were involved directly. But even then, the Syrians had the most up-to-date stuff that they could get from the Russians at that moment because of Syria's importance to Russia. And it was a very sophisticated system. and would have required an enormous military effort to overcome it. And in the process, as was admitted, as you indicated recently, by or at least when she gave the talks to Goldman Sachs, Hillary Clinton admitted that this would involve a lot of Syrian civilian casualties because it would be a very large U.S. Bombing operation, and it could not be isolated from civilian centers, from populated areas.
What risk of starting a war with Russia would a no-fly zone present?
Well, there's no doubt that if the United States were to actually try to carry out a policy of preventing the Russians and the Assad government from carrying out military operations that involves bombing, that it would directly provoke a conflict with the Russians in Syria. I mean, there's no other way around it. I mean, it's not possible to imagine that the Russians are going to fold up their tents and allow the United States to do whatever it wants at the cost of allowing the opposition to continue its war and basically giving up. That's simply not a credible possibility, in my view.
So is there anything the outside world can do in the face of this humanitarian catastrophe?
Well, you know, this is it does present dilemmas. I mean, no matter how you act, no matter what you do, you're going to have problems as a result of it. But of course, yes, there is something that is within the power of the United States to do, and that is to use all the leverage at its disposal to tell its Sunni allies, Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, that continuing to supply al-Qaeda with weapons and to allow their fighters to cross the border between Turkey and Syria is not acceptable to the United States, and that this would directly affect the alliances that the United States has had with these three countries. Now, Turkey, of course, is the only formal military ally of the United States. It's a member of NATO. But all three countries are allies in the sense that they have provided military bases to the United States or indirectly control military bases, which are important to the U.S. military. And so this really comes down to a question of whether the United States is ready to put at risk its access to military bases in order to have leverage over these countries, these Sunni allies in the region, to make sure that this war does not continue indefinitely. That would be, you know, if you're asking me what I would do, that's what I would do, because this was a policy that the United States should have recognized from the beginning, the policy of tolerating and then actually becoming complicit in an active way, the arming of the opposition. When they knew that this opposition was dominated by al-Qaeda, this is something that should not have been tolerated, something that the Obama administration should have said no to from the beginning. But it's still not too late today to reverse that. Unfortunately, of course, the politics of this country in various ways make that not just unlikely, but really, you know, politically impossible.
That was the Washington-based journalist and historian Gareth Porter. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Mercenaries are useless, disunited, unfaithful. They have nothing more to keep them in a battle other than a meager wage, which is just about enough to make them want to kill for you, but not enough to make them want to die for you. We'll be right back.
That was some of Mercenaries by John Cale. Next, Jerry Davis. He is the author, along with Johann Chu, of a paper in the November issue of the American Journal of Sociology called Who Killed the Inner Circle? The Decline of the American Corporate Interlock Network. The paper examines the disappearance of what we might call professional directors, an inner circle at the peak of corporate life consisting of people serving on multiple corporate boards of directors that once served as the nucleus of a corporate ruling class. What happened? Why? And what does it all mean? In the interview, we talk about the public corporation, a term of art that may not be familiar to civilians. It refers to a firm owned by a large number of stockholders, as opposed to a private one owned by an individual or a partnership. In recent decades, private equity firms, large pools of cash contributed by institutions and rich people, run by money managers, like Bain of Mitt Romney fame, or Blackstone, whose poster boy is Steve Schwarzman, have taken over more and more companies by buying up all their public stock and converting a firm to narrow private ownership. They've gotten so prominent that people are starting to talk about the eclipse of the public corporation. Here's Jerry Davis with more. So the interlocking directorate is an old concept in American politics, American economy. It was a big deal a century ago in the populist movement. Give us some idea of what is this interlocking directorate? How has it figured in political and social analysis over the years?
Yeah, this is one of those ideas about social networks that goes back over a century. So Louis Brandeis, who ultimately was a Supreme Court justice, published this book in 1914 called Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It. And he talked about how J.P. Morgan and the two other big New York banks would send their partners out to serve on corporate boards. And he said, look, J.P. Morgan and his partners serve on 72 different boards, and it's competitors in all these different industries, GE and Westinghouse. And this is a sort of an un-American concentration of power. It gave finance the ability to control industry. And Brandeis thought this is a terrible thing. Not only will finance control industry, but they'll control politics because sort of they're the ones that control the supply of new monies. Well, so that was published in 1914, and by the end of the First World War, that had really fallen apart. Bankers resigned their board memberships in 1914, sort of en masse after the Clayton Act. But this idea that people serving on multiple boards had some kind of significance or was some kind of trace of power continued and turned out to be true basically for 100 years, almost 100 years after that. In sociology, there's this vibrant literature saying, what are the effects when you've got people on the J.P. Morgan board in sort of 1980 serving on 50 other corporate boards? Is this a sort of source of power or what's going on there? And some of the research suggested this was a means for corporate elites or business elites to be able to work out their differences behind closed doors and sort of present a united front. So they were going to be more effective in politics if they found some means of working out their differences, because you expect steel companies to want tariffs against Chinese steels and auto companies to not want tariffs because they like cheap steel. So one of the notions was that you could use these networks as a way to engage in coordinated action. And there's some evidence that that's true. When executives serve on the same bank boards, they tend to give to the same political candidates and so on. And that was a state of play by about 2000. If you look at Bush's cabinet, it was astounding how many boards those people served on. Dick Cheney, Paul O'Neill, Donald Rumsfeld, and Elaine Chao, who in addition to being married to Mitch McConnell, served on 9 corporate boards before she became labor secretary. So that was where things stood in about 2001.
In your paper, you discussed the fact that it's not only that this cohort of multiple board servers provides a political coherence to that class or subclass, but it's also a way of class recruitment and grooming and acculturation, right?
Yeah, that was what Mike Youssef wrote about in the early 1980s. He had this lovely book called The Inner Circle that picked up where C. Wright Mills left off with the power elite, saying, how do you end up being one of those people that serves on 5, 6, 7, 8 boards? And he traced the biographies of the kind of people that end up in those positions. And it was pretty fascinating. He was looking at the psychology of what do you learn when you serve on a bank board and a pharmaceutical company board and, I don't know, Council on Foreign Relations or whatever it might be. And his argument was that they ended up having this fairly broad view because they had a lot of perspectives to take in, that they could serve this moderating function.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Morgan earlier, and at the end of Vincent Carrasco's gigantic book on the Morgans, he quotes a unnamed socialist as saying, some people regretted Morgan's trustification and service on many boards and all that, but we welcome it as an end to competition. As socialists, you know, this is progress towards a less competitive and more regulated, organized society. I mean, did these kinds of interlocking directorates provide any kind of cohesiveness like that, economically or politically?
That's certainly what the theory is. For insiders, I think they'd say, no, we still argue with each other. There really isn't that kind of cohesion. Weirdly enough, one of the folks that favored that, you know, the socialist view would be Lenin. And if you go back to his 1916 book, Imperialism, the Highest Form of Capitalism, his claim was that in every industrial economy, particularly Germany and the U.S., you see industry becoming concentrated and finance becoming concentrated and finance taking control of industry. So from his perspective, you know, that basically tees things up for someone that wants to take state control of industry. So if the banks already control all the competition, then if you take over the banks, you know, you've won. I think that was a bit naive, but it was certainly a thought that if you could concentrate things first, it makes it a bit easier to control. If you had to point to someone that took those ideas possibly the farthest, this is going to sound heretical, it might be Richard Nixon.
How do you figure that?
We will pause for a gasp here, but if you look at all of the things that big business hates the most about regulation, all the things that annoyed them in the 1970s, there was the EPA, OSHA, Consumer Product Safety Committee, and the EEOC getting litigation authority in 1972. And so, shockingly, the president that put in place the most consistent controls over big business that rankled business the most was Nixon. So if we could just, you know, control the 200 biggest firms, then we could make employment more fair, make workplaces safer, aid the environment. Admittedly, these weren't Nixon's personal ideas, but it did happen during his administration.
Well, those are the things that got the corporate elite mobilized in the 70s, that, you know, through the business roundtable, you know, the famous Powell memo, all that. Those kinds of regulations were really, to them, anathema, and they really organized a class conscious rebellion against it.
I would say that's right. That really was the turning point, was after Nixon's administration and after the Powell memo. That was the moment when big business as a collective really found its footing and took on the sort of anti-state or anti-federal political view that we associate with them now, and that, you know, we think of the Reagan administration as being the apotheosis of that. That was really the business backlash against federal regulations that were largely put in place during Nixon's term.
And that the inner circle we're talking about, this, you know, these multiple board members who served on each other's boards and knew each other quite well, they formalized those relations through things like the Business Roundtable, right, that during the 70s, you know, led that bourgeois rebellion.
Yeah, the Business Roundtable is probably the most preferred representation of big business as a group finding a common voice. It's the CEOs of the 200 or so biggest companies, and they're meant to represent the voice of sort of big business as a collective, as opposed to, say, the National Association of Manufacturers.
Now, I've noticed, reading the newspapers and such, that, you know, that kind of cohesion has disappeared. And I've read books and interviewed their authors saying that part of the reason is, you know, they won and they demobilized politically and became much more interested just in specific sectoral issues, things that affected their industries or their companies, and much less interested in broad political questions of the sort that mobilized that 70s cohort. But the decay of this inner circle is also an explanatory possibility, right?
Yeah, that's one of the claims that that we made in our piece for The Conversation, was if having 200 people that serve on five or more corporate boards and see each other every month, if that was a means of getting some kind of political or other kinds of cohesion, then if that network falls apart, you might expect to see sort of more idiosyncrasies. And you have to see that the candidacy of Donald Trump as being something pretty surprising in American politics. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about a month ago that found that zero CEOs in the Fortune 100 had donated to Trump. Zero is a really small number. A third of them had donated to Mitt Romney at the same time 4 years ago. No one in business, no one in big business supports Trump. You have to ask, well, if corporate money controls politics, how did the Republicans, the party of business, nominate someone that no one in business supports? And that seemed like a surprising puzzle. So we thought, you know, part of the reason might be that we no longer have those sort of mediating institutions that allow people to act collectively, that there really isn't a mechanism where corporate elites are able to easily gather together and get their way.
Now, you demonstrate this point through statistical rigor, so but could you translate it into radio ease, what your findings are?
Yeah, so with Johan Chu, who's a professor at the University of Chicago, we looked at every corporate board and the Standard & Poor's 1500, so the 1500 biggest corporations in the U.S. from about 1997 onward, and we found that in the late 90s, people that served on three, four, five boards were much likely to get appointed to new boards. It was a sign of prestige that you served on all these boards, that you were a member of this inner circle. And after the corporate scandals of the early 2000s, the business press and others started turning against them. They said, well, Enron, WorldCom, these things wouldn't have happened if the board was paying attention. If you serve on five or six boards, you can't really be paying attention. Therefore, we blame the inner circle, in a sense, that directors who serve on too many boards just aren't paying enough attention. So Institutional Shareholder Services, which is a company that advises big institutions on how to vote their proxies, how to vote on things like director elections, they said in 2004, we recommend you vote against anyone that serves on too many boards. And for them, six was too many. But companies got the message and they started adopting these policies that said, nobody can join our board if they're already on three or four outside boards. So companies themselves codified this, and they stopped recruiting members of the inner circle. And so it went from being, if you're on five boards, you're much more likely to get onto a sixth, to if you're on three boards, you'll never get another invitation. And if you follow that through for a few years, the entire network collapses. So in 2000, that's sort of the height of this movement, there were about 200 people that served on five or more boards. Last year, two.
I'm speaking with Jerry Davis of the University of Michigan. That's a remarkable transformation. The finger wagging from Business Week probably couldn't make a crucial difference, might help. But what were the forces behind the adoption of this new rule?
So when Sarbanes-Oxley was passed in 2002, they sort of pointed the finger at bad corporate governance, meaning sort of bad boards of directors, boards not paying enough attention. And there was a sort of swell of support for reforming corporate governance. Now, there have been similar swells going back for generations. This one, though, it had a bit of a bite. People felt, yeah, boards really are falling asleep at the switch here. There were so many scandals and such well-known sort of companies like Enron and WorldCom, so many failures in the dot-com boom, Arthur Andersen going out of business. There was a feeling we need to do something to rein in corporate governance. It's really hard to tell who's going to be a good director. You look at their biography and you say, Elaine Chao, sure, she's probably going to be a great director. She's got a Harvard MBA. She's married to Mitch McConnell. But if you wanted to find something that seemed unambiguous and easy to track, how many boards are you on? And it's such a simple thing to target, that seemed to really take off. And when institutional investors started saying, we're going to give extra scrutiny to people on multiple boards, that got some play. One of the ironies, there was an article in Forbes called America's Most Overworked Directors in 2002, and it had pictures of the five most overworked directors serving on corporate boards. And so if you imagine what they looked like, you imagine Dick Cheney smoking a cigar at the Bohemian Grove. But that wasn't really the case. Four of the five were African American, and they did not look like an old boys club. You know, the person that ended up maintaining the most board memberships over time was Shirley Ann Jackson, who was a MIT PhD and president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. If I asked Doug Henwood in 1995, what would you do to reform corporate boards, you might say, well, we need more women, more academics, more people of color. Shirley Ann Jackson, she's sort of your perfect candidate. And that's the kind of ironic thing was, after boards had reached a certain level of diversity, then suddenly being on multiple boards went from being a great honor to being a stigma.
These 200 multiple board servers, were they, you know, aside from, you know, people like Shirley Ann Jackson or Vernon Jordan, were these people chosen for their sharp eyes and ability to scrutinize management and the balance sheet, or were they just there for prestige and the CEO and the top management team were the ones who really ran the company? Did these people exert any supervisory function at all? Why were they there? Who were they?
You can definitely think about both sides of this. Someone who serves on 5, 6, 7 boards, they've seen everything. They've fired CEOs. They've responded to investors. I mean, there's a lot of value in that kind of experience. If you're going to monthly board meetings at 5 different companies, you're going to gather a lot of insight just from having that level of experience. Someone who's on one board, they don't know any better. You know, they're on one board, they do their best. But someone that's seen complicated situations handled in very different industries, I think that could bring, you know, potentially some real value to the company. On the other hand, it could be that they just collect their check and don't do that much work. It's really hard to tell from the outside. That's part of the dilemma, is all you know when you're looking at directors is you see their biographical sketch on the proxy statement and say, oh, this person has this degree and they serve on these 5 other boards. That sounds good to me. So it's kind of hard to tell. The 200 number was very high in 2000 because this was just before the dot-com collapse in March of 2000. And so sometimes it's one venture capitalist serving on 10 or 12 different boards. So that's not the standard inner circle story. That's venture capitalists and lawyers in Silicon Valley serving on a whole bunch of different boards for smaller startup type companies.
And what was the contribution of the so-called shareholder revolution? You know, we had Michael Jensen theorizing we need to end the public corporation. Boards were not exerting any kind of supervisory function. The shareholders were being screwed by management. A massive movement, if you want to call it that, takeover artists and such, who went after the conventional public corporation beginning in the 80s. And try to transform it. What was the contribution of that shareholder revolution to the changes you're outlining?
Essentially, the shareholders have won. You know, that revolution was already pretty much over by about 1990. So in the 80s, about 1 in 3 Fortune 500 companies got taken over. 28% got tender offers, meaning outsiders offering to buy control of the board without necessarily checking with management. And by the 90s, that battle, by the time you wrote Wall Street in 1997, that ship had sailed. They had already won, and every CEO said, our company exists to create shareholder value. So one of the consequences of that is that during the 1990s, CEOs said, well, if conglomerates are bad, if focus is good, then maybe we should be outsourcing different aspects of our value chain. Companies started to look more like Nike. Nike designs and markets sneakers in Oregon, but they don't do the actual production. Well, the same thing has happened to the entire electronics industry, the pharmaceutical industry, pet food, you name it. The company whose name is on the brand isn't really the one that's manufacturing that stuff. They've got outside contractors doing it. So I was initially great for shareholder value. You can increase return on equity either by increasing returns, net income or profit, or reducing assets. And it's a lot easier to reduce assets by selling off businesses. So you see IBM and Sara Lee and companies like this sort of hiving off different businesses to focus on the intellectual property. Shareholders loved it. You got higher valuations when you didn't have heavy assets. But the irony was that it made it possible for small companies that weren't necessarily publicly traded to go to those same vendors and say, maybe you could make sneakers for me. Maybe you could make cell phones for me. The biggest TV company in the U.S. in 2010 was Vizio, not Sony, Vizio, with 200 people in Irvine, California. They just contracted out the supply chain. So the irony of the shareholder value thing was that it made it possible for non-shareholder-owned tiny companies to do the same thing that Sony did. And that's where we are today. We've reached this point where companies have become so hollowed out that it sort of no longer makes sense to be a public corporation. If you want to kill off the corporate elite, kill off the corporation. That's really what's happened over the last 20 years. There's about half as many listed companies today as there were 20 years ago, and it just keeps going down.
Yeah, I was going to mention, you know, over the same period of time, we've seen the growing importance for private equity. And then in this venture capital bubble, where, you know, that's created the unicorns like Uber and such, very few of these companies seem to want to go public, very in sharp contrast to the dot-com years. What does this mean? I mean, is this the end of the public corporation that Michael Jensen was writing about 35 years ago?
I think it is the end of, for the most part, the end of the public corporation, but not for the reasons Michael Jensen was saying. He felt that you can never resolve the problem of different incentives facing managers and investors. There's no way to deal with that agency problem effectively. I think the real reason is that production technology, the way that production is organized now, just doesn't favor big corporations. If you can rent server space, you can rent employees on Upwork, you can use an app to hire drivers, you don't need to go public. You can fund that on a pretty small base. And so arguably, the reason why we had corporations was they needed to invest in long-lived assets. They were building factories in Detroit or making soup in Camden or putting Sears stores across the country or building railroads. If your business is an app, there's no earthly reason for you to be a public corporation. You can rent the assets that you need rather than buying them. So why put up with the trouble of going to the public markets? Why have activist investors hounding you? Why let the public know what your salary is? I mean, an example for you, I don't know if you've talked on your show about the conflict minerals provision in Dodd-Frank.
No, we haven't.
So in the Dodd-Frank Act from 2010 included a section that requires public corporations to report whether they're buying tantalum, tungsten, tin, or gold from the Democratic Republic of Congo. They had to trace their supply chains to see if they're funding warlords. It's pretty costly to do this because it's 5, 6, 7 steps back in the supply chain. Companies have a very difficult time knowing whether they're supporting conflict in the DRC. Well, Hewlett-Packard had to put that effort in because they're a listed company. Dell does not because they're a private company. They're owned by private equity and Michael Dell. So if you can escape from, you know, the sort of public scrutiny, and by the way, Dell is actually doing a reasonable job with their conflict minerals, but they're not legally required to the way that a Hewlett-Packard would in basically the same industry. So, you know, why put up with the trauma of being a public corporation if you can be private and do things on the DL?
What do all the changes you've been describing do to, I have a two-part question. One, the working class, and two, our politics. Let's start, what does it do to the working class?
So the working class is the easier one. In this new book I have, I refer to it as Uberization, which is we've gone from careers to jobs, and now we're going from jobs to tasks. So a task is different from a job because you're getting paid a piece rate to drive someone to the airport or to pick up someone's laundry. So the on-demand economy, or what you might call platform capitalism, is really enabling markets to penetrate much deeper than they had before. So if you took a job at General Electric, you might be there for your entire life and work your way up and invest in various skills. No one now would expect a General Electric to be around in 5 years. Instead, we're enabling this sort of pop-up market, which is great for consumers who have all these wonderful conveniences from Uber and TaskRabbit and so on. But for labor, this is a really different flavor of challenge. I mean, it's really different to organize people who have not jobs but tasks, various flavors of tasks in the gig economy. That just looks really different from organizing against, you know, the Rouge plant at Ford. Dark clouds ahead for labor unless we can figure out some way to think about what does this economy look like? How do we organize to provide people with basic levels of security, health insurance, retirement security? Corporations don't go away and we give health insurance through corporate jobs. That's a big problem to be solved.
And then what about politics?
That one's going to be harder for me because I'm not sure that it points in any particular direction. It's a weird thing when you have Republicans hating the Export-Import Bank, which the biggest exporting businesses like Boeing and GE love. So that feels like a bit of a weird fissure, the demands of what big business wants, what small business wants, and then what these new economy firms want. It's not clear what sort of political interest that adds up to. I think we're seeing some of the mystery around this in Silicon Valley, where we have Peter Thiel supporting Trump and giving a speech for Trump, and sort of the rest of Silicon Valley saying, what are you thinking there? The answer that one might like to see is an updated version of the progressive movement. At the beginning of the 20th century, Teddy Roosevelt and Brandeis and others said, wow, these new corporations are really big and really economical, but they have to be controlled. We need to have the right regulations in place. We need an inheritance tax, a federal income tax that's graduated. You know, that program of the early progressives was about taming the corporation. What would it look like to tame platform capitalism when things are done more on markets and less through established institutions? How do we rein that in? I think that's what the project will be.
That was Jerry Davis of the University of Michigan. Davis has a new book out, The Vanishing American Corporation, from Barrett Kohler Publishers. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Aelita by Yo La Tengo. I was feeling nostalgic for 1980s Hoboken. Till next week, bye.
Raised your voice and found it made.